Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the After Things podcast. I'm Adrian Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Hello, beautiful people.
So, After Things is a podcast where we talk to other creatives about being a creative professional, give our advice. Sometimes people have some questions relating to businesses they're doing and, you know, want to pick the brain trust brains.
want to pick redundancy. The trust out of our brains. They want to make us resent everyone.
Yes. Allow myself to introduce myself.
Yeah.
And we've got to start off with a question. This is from Gavin Raykemper. And very simple, to the point question says, what tools would you use for ebook publishing to multiple platforms, online services, what applications, et cetera? It says, I think you guys talked about it a while back.
Well, that's so interesting.
I will, I'll jump in first. My tool of choice for creating ebooks now is Vellum. Now, it's a Mac-only piece of software at present, but I love it because it creates beautifully formatted ebooks. You can output it to whatever formats you need. If you want to output it to, you know, the Kindle format, if you want to output it to Google Play, to Nook, etc., it is creates a very, very nice, elegant looking book. You can choose your choice. You can use fancy drop caps, etc. You pay per book, so you pay a fee for each book that you want to convert. And I found that it's very easy to do updates because you go in there and you just make your changes in that version there, and then you output and it just uploads to your Dropbox folder and just rewrites whatever versions you have. So I found that it has made my life so much easier when it comes to ebook publication. I went back and I took all my old ebooks and I put it in there so I could go in and create better looking ebooks. So it allows to do, you know, tables of contents. You can integrate images. It was created, you could tell these people have a really good graphic design sense, which is problematic in the publishing industry. That's actually kind of rare. And most people in the industry don't realize how they don't have any kind of graphic design sense too.
Sure, sure.
Which makes it even more complicated. So that is my Mac tool. That is my first and foremost pick. If you're not on Mac, if you don't want to use that, there is a free software which is called Calibri. It's a open source ebook library management system which allows you to convert, to take a document and convert it into other formats. So you can convert it into, you know, EPUB, all these other different versions you might need. So you could take like an original, I believe, like start with a Word document and then convert it into that. Now, when you want to take a book and you want to take, let's say, a Microsoft Word document or Scrivener, which I love to work with, and convert it. Now, Scrivener will do it itself, can convert it to those formats, but to get that really nice layout, it gets tricky, and that's why I like Vellum. You need to make sure that you use proper headings. You have to say, this is a chapter. This is a title. This is what this is. Because if your document doesn't have that information, no ebook conversion software in the world will be able to figure that out. You know, you have to be able to go in there, and some of the more intelligent ones look for certain things to say, okay, we think maybe if it is not marked chapter, if it's marked strong, then maybe this is it. It has to know what your how your document lays out as a book. That's the problem. And so that's a really good software can figure that out. So either Vellum is my first pick by and large, big, and I've shown this to other people in the ebook industry, and they're like, oh, well, we're Windows, but we may go Mac just to use this.
I'm going to disagree with you on Calibri, because I've never had bigger nightmares than trying to get formatting stuff worked out, using that software. It's like just converting a 30-page booklet over and putting pictures in was a damn nightmare. And then keep in mind, this is data that's 3 or 4 years old and well, almost certainly has gotten better.
Pictures are problematic because it's not a layout thing. It's really the EPUB format sort of reluctantly supports photos as sort of inline images.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's a problem. And you're right. You're right that if you're trying to do things that are photos, if you're just trying to do straight text, but if it's other than just an inline photo, Yeah, that's the problem is how do you avoid having to go to InDesign or go all the way up to something else?
Correct. There is a free solution that is all cloud-based that once you build it in there, it will distribute it to all major platforms on the iBook store, on Amazon and all that stuff. It was called Vook.com, V-O-O-K, but now they've relaunched as Pronoun.com.
Yeah.
And they've got, I think you didn't like, if I remember correctly, you didn't like their distribution model, but now the way they make their money, you get 100% of the royalties. They make their money with their existing literary tracking information business, side business they have. So basically, they pretty much are just funding the keep the servers that were going for Vook.com and
yeah. But so here's my thing about Pronoun. Okay, and I've talked to these people. I've done screencasts with them and all that. Is that there were. As the system was presented to me, they upload and yeah, they handle the distribution there. And guess what? You don't get paid until you get paid quarterly based upon after Amazon pays them.
Right.
And so you don't control your Amazon account for the book anymore.
Yeah, no, that's accurate. I guess I haven't really worried about that because. Period. Full stop.
I'm seeing is like it to me. It's ridiculous to give that up. You're giving up control over knowing what your daily sales are, control over pricing, being able to change.
You know what? That's actually that is a totally valid point. If you're somebody who wants to be able to manage and deal with fires as they happen, if somebody puts a review that unfairly maligns something, you want to be able to call and deal with it firsthand. I definitely you do lose all of that by going with
I pointed out three errors in their terms of agreement, which were inconsistent, and they still haven't updated it. You know, I mean, they're nice people, but I was very, very, I would not recommend it because they they get paid by Amazon.
Yep.
Right. Then they pay you through PayPal. So then PayPal does take a percentage out. So you're going to lose 3% plus whatever. So it's
I don't know. You know what? I should check and see because I believe they were doing direct deposit on mine. But then again, I haven't tuned in to see what that's been looking like lately.
So understand like that. So they pay you 30 to 60 days, you know, after like Amazon pays you every end of every month on Amazon, you get paid like 30 days later, you get paid there. Well, then Pronoun goes in there. It's like just there are other services to like, you know, look up ebook conversion, whatever, where you're not because then they control your title on Amazon. And there, if you want to do promotions, if you want to go turn around and do pricing changes, things like that, you have to go ask them to say, hey, can you do that? And there to me, it just was like, there's not an upside to this.
Oh, hey, yeah. No, they did flip over to PayPal. Oh, man, I'm done and wrong. Oh, hey, I made money. Well, that's cool. For me, Pronoun was a good solution to do a media rich, because of course we tried a bunch of nutty things on the Scam School books where we had, kind of director's commentary audio tracks. We had embedded video illustration showing all that stuff. And that was just nightmarish with anything other than this cloud-based platform. And then the idea of having to do it once and then redo it all for a different format between, you know, the different distribution things was insane. So, but yes, you do give up a lot to do it that way.
I would recommend if you want instead, if you go to, let's say, like CreateSpace, you go through there and you can create a print version and then they will automatically create for you for free. You can take your Word document into CreateSpace. You can create a print version. Then you can create an ebook version. I don't know if they do, if they support EPUB or they just do directly to Kindle sort of conversion. That's problematic if you want to do something other than that. But, you know, you would think this day and age, these things would be a lot easier, but they're not. And the problem too is that you had a number of companies that started around 2011 when ebooks were starting to really take off in the Kindle, and you had companies got funded and they're all trying to figure out how they're going to get into this. And, you know, it's Amazon's game. You know, it's Amazon's business. You know, it's everybody else is just an afterthought.
Yeah, and exactly. Exactly. So
those are recommendations again. But you know what? And I recommend take a look at Pronoun though. Don't go by just what I said. Take a look at that, but understand that, you know, it is you no longer really control the title, and, you know, there's that. And, you know, and again, everybody there that I talked to was super cool, super nice. But, you know, when I talk to other authors, like active authors, it's one of these things like, okay, so I give up all this control, all this pricing data, all this other information because I don't control my Amazon account for the book.
Well, but maybe it really is like, I mean, because I don't really think of myself as an author, but I made books and I just wanted them to be out. And, you know, whatever people are going to say about them, however many units are sold or whatever, it's not my living, right? It was supplementary income, and it was a trade-off of ease of distribution for the loss of all that control.
Yeah, and I think when you used Vook, I think they created beautifully laid out books. I think it did a really good design. I think it did a really good thing of that, you know. And I think that's a trade-off. Everybody has their different sort of, you know, threshold of what they want to do or not. And I understand like your Calibri problems, like, yeah, because it's not a layout tool, you know, for just regular text and stuff.
Yeah.
And doing any kind of images is difficult. You know, I think that Vellum is pretty good, but it's hard because like if you want to do, you know, an ebook format is a very linear thing. It says text here, photo here, text here, photo here. It's not because it has to be able to adapt to different screen sizes. It has to be able to adapt to a desktop, to a phone. And where photos and things like that should be laid out on a mobile device is very different than how it might look somewhere else. And so there are all these choices that have to be made. And, you know, that gets to be problematic. And it's amazing when you see how, and that's been, you know, we'll talk at some point more about it. I've been working on a very easy to read mobile format for making it easy to share samples of your books and trying to come up with I think I've shown this before, my text format, like my page format, because the goal was like, how do you make it easy to share a book? And if you go to Amazon and you click on like, you know, take a look inside the book, it literally shows you, you know, an example of the book page, but it looks like, you know, it's not really a fun format to read. So it's literally the, you know, the inside of the book, you know, which,
yeah. Yeah.
It's not that. So I came up with a format, if I can show you on the camera here.
Wow, that looks great.
So what that is that it's a format that it's got drop caps. It's got everything. I created a very easy, you press one button to increase the font size on it. And so you can increase. So if this will look the same on a Kindle as it will on your desktop computer. And I went in and created like a special CSS script, figures out what kind of device you're using, figures out how to format the text to fit it, uses a proper font. So many examples of reading like books online, like they do spaces between paragraphs, which is not a format you normally use in fiction. They don't do drop caps. They don't do write justified. There are all these little things that aren't done because, you know, print typography is different than web typography. But when you want to pull out a reader, I said, well, you know, what's the best way of reading it in a Kindle? And so how do I make it look like that? So that's part of a larger project called Writer Tool, which I was showing Bryce before, which is basically to make it very easy for authors to create web pages, to upload their books, to provide samples, and to do all of that. And it'll be totally free. So
right on.
We'll get into that some other point. But that's been, you know, I've been digging into looking around at, you know, best practices for creating websites. And I would certainly say that, you know, I push a lot of people towards Squarespace because it's you know, when you want a lot of customizability, but you don't want to have to get into back end uploading things to a server.
Sure.
Squarespace has it, but it's still very – my problem with Squarespace is that unless you're like, you know, a photo blogger, you know, it's when you try to make it particular to your taste, and if you're a person that does – certain kinds of commerce or things like that, it gets much more problematic. And if you don't have a bunch of high-res photos of you snowboarding, it's, you know, you have to look past any service. You have to look past how they do the photos to actually what you're doing. And a lot of the standard templates people use now is they use sort of this one-page sort of parallax thing where things scroll up towards you.
Mm-hmm.
I find that hard to read. I find that not at all a pleasurable experience. It looks beautiful, but it's beauty over function.
Yeah, my problem is that not enough people are using code ROGUE at checkout. That's ROGUE to get 10% off your purchase and keep the Modern Rogue in business.
I think it's a great start. I think it's a great starting place if you're trying to figure where to go. But I'll just say that I send friends there and then they just
No. I mean, it looks especially like the whole playing a video in the background thing, I think looks pretty dope. If you go to themodernrogue.com, you can see we threw that together on – I say we, I mean Brant – threw it together on Squarespace, and it does, you know, it's like the bar, like there's no more excuse for just a garbage looking website now in a world where Squarespace exists. Do we have another question, or is that the only one we got this week?
I'm giving up trying to figure out how to spell that right.
the show just becomes only trying to the spelling bee.
That was one of the questions. We had a comment last week. I think it was Joe Diamond. We talked about, he explained that, you know, where he performs in, that it's hot and that's why he wears the short sleeves, which I believe and I accept. Short sleeve and a vest, something. Just saying, you know, these for images. Just sell.
Well, and also it's like, I don't know, the pictures when you're there in the moment are like just at least the pictures on the website, right? The way you represent the spirit of what's happening. That's what matters.
He says, you know, he's got I guess Halloween season looks booked. Everything's doing really well. And so he's doing really well. He's done a really, really good job, I think, on his website and everything else. And that's, man, that's the hardest part is, you know, when it comes to web stuff and things like that, and for giving you a lot of functionality, you cannot, I think Squarespace does a great job of that. It gives you a lot of functionality. And with anything, you know, the problem is we set out to do something and we think it's going to be easy, but the problem is it may be easy, but we have to make choices that we're not prepared for. And that's when fatigue sets in, and that's when we give up, is because we're like, oh, I need to choose an image. Well, now I'm going to spend the next 30 minutes trying to choose the perfect image for this. And my little fatigue tank of how much fatigue I can handle is being drained. And all of a sudden, you give up.
We got a good question in the chat. Gethraken says, chat question for Andrew. Want to publish short stories, but the shorts are going to be backstories and snippets for a novel he's working on. What rights does he give away in publishing the shorts? I believe traditionally none, right? I mean, if it's getting published, you always own the copyright unless you're doing a work for hire gig.
Yeah, I mean, it depends who. Yeah, I mean, where are you talking about publishing them? Are you talking about to, like, as part of an anthology? Where is this, you know, stuff that you're giving away on your website? You know, a little more clarity on that. But, you know, there are a lot of standard publishing deals where, you know, they get the rights to publish it and that thing, but then you own it. But then sometimes people try hanky things. And, you know, that's been problematic too, is that sometimes you read through terms of services on stuff and they're not intended to be like make you give away more than you plan, but sometimes they give away more than you plan. And Brian and I can both attest to.
Sure, sure.
You know, that yes, this is what's on paper and we go do what we're doing. And then they later on go, yeah, but now we told you we didn't mean it, but now we mean this.
Yeah. Well, and you're dangerously close to getting me wanting to talk about those situations. The magic phrase I look for is work for hire. Work for hire means any work that you do, they own 100% of, and you are just a contractor to provide them with a thing. My guess is if it's a publisher that wants to be around for any amount of time, that they probably have some fairly industry standard verbiage in there.
Yeah. And I will say that, like, I remember once I got asked by a TV show, they wanted permission to use like a couple of my books, a couple of my magic books in a scene. And I'm like, oh yeah, sure. But let me look at your agreement. And the agreement was that I gave them all rights in perpetuity, right, to use it.
Yeah.
And I know what they meant was they just meant that, like, if they use a poster or a photo or whatever, and if it ever appears, they don't want me, you know, appears, and they want me to go in and suing them because it showed up on, you know, TV and set India or, you know, somewhere else like this or
right,
whatever. But the problem is that it's a book, and they, by me signing that agreement, I actually gave them, they would have publishing rights on the book. They didn't want that. They care less about that. But they would have those rights, right?
Which suddenly puts you in an awkward position. Let's say for whatever reason you did want to sell those rights to somebody, you would technically not have that. That would not be yours to sell.
I couldn't give an exclusive. You know, I could not give an exclusive right to somebody else like that. And I couldn't in good faith say yes. And so, and that was like, I told them, like, that's like, this is problematic. And then it's like, they're like, all right. And I'm like, you know, it's just going to be too much of a problem to do that. And I know somebody else who did it, you know, and like their playing cards or something like that. I'm like, you know, they can make your cards now and they could go do that, you know? And I'm like, you know, if Bicycle wants to buy your design, they can't.
Well, and it's the second scenario that's the real bugger on there, right?
Yeah, I mean, unlikely, but that's the problematic, because it's also like for them, it wasn't worth it to rewrite it. And I get it. But, and that's, so yeah, you always want to read those things and be, you know, pay attention. And sometimes things are intentionally put there. Sometimes things are not, and you may have the person you may negotiate a contract with may be acting in completely good faith, but if those rights are assignable, which means that they can go to somebody else or sell that on to another party, you know, little peeking behind the curtain here, Brian, Justin, myself have been talking to people about a project, and you know, we bring in an agent to look at the contracts on stuff because, you know, he points out like, okay, you want to have an assignability where they certainly, if they get bought by a bigger company or whatever, they want to do that. We want to make that okay, but we want to make sure they can't sell it to a smaller company or whatever.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, I don't know. For what you're describing, though, for a series of short stories, because it doesn't sound like you're doing it for the money. Sounds like you're doing it for the exposure and the credit, as he's mentioning in the chat. Just look at the agreement. My guess is you'll be A-okay.
Yeah, did he ever answer what it's for?
He says, online magazine?
Yeah, online magazine. Specifically, he wanted to get a SFWA credit, a Science Fiction Writers of America credit. Which,
fantastic.
Yeah.
I'm working on a project with them right now, actually.
Well, maybe you could put in a good word.
Yeah, the things I've been showing you that may relate to that project with them. So, you know. Trying to help authors, trying to make it easier to share short stories and stuff. So, and other stuff. But yeah, I think, if they're working at SFWA, it's a great organization. They're very, very pro author. So, you know, read through it, but I think you should be fine. I think it's good. I think writing more short stories is great. It's a great way to reel people into your content. It's a great way to work on your craft. And it's a format that nobody owns. Nobody's really figured out how to make it really work either, but
right,
we shall see. Brian,
dude, you want to talk about? I think you nailed it all on the head. Hey, as far as picks, I'm only doing this pick because he's not here anymore. But I sincerely can't say enough about how exciting it is to watch Justin Young being a part of the launch of a new cable network, or I guess online news network. You know, BTN. If you go to btlive.tv, there's a bunch of stuff. Right now, I've watched it because I'm an old-fashioned desktop PC guy, and it's just enough of a pain in the ass to get on there that it's easier for me to look at the bootleg YouTube stream. But that's going to be happening at diamondclub.tv all this week, and just turn it on. If you're going to have noise in the background, why not have it be Justin Robert Young's noise? Because he makes good noise, that one.
Yeah, I got to tell you, I've had twice this week, I've had friends say, hey, check out my thing that I'm doing. And I wasn't quite sure on how to do it. It was like, wait, I create an account here, or I do this, or I do that. And I'm like, am I old, or are some of these mediums trying too hard to build a garden, build a wall before they have a garden?
Yeah. Well, and that's fine. I mean, I think I like the fact that it's a very BitTorrent way of handling this, where it's like, we want to do this. The opportunity is now. Let's go first and figure it out later. I'm sorry. It looked like you had something to say.
No.
Oh. No. Okay.
No. I'm so proud of Justin. So proud to see what he's doing. So it's so exciting to see him do that. You know, of course, like the first image I see was him in, you know, as a Pokemon character.
Yeah, dressed up as a Charmander covering the Republican National Convention. It was amazing.
Of course. This is what he's bringing to journalism. I hope when he goes back to Syracuse to speak at Newhouse that he wears that, you know.
Yes. I keep saying the word bootleg in that it's apparently not their preferred distribution plan, because I know they have a dedicated app and all that other stuff. But it looks like we decided this was a legit channel, right? BitTorrent
yes.
News?
Yes. And okay. So we can embed YouTube Live, which is what we've been doing last week on diamondclub.tv.
Yeah, listen, it's BitTorrent, so it's not like, what are they going to do? Complain?
Yeah, right? Yeah, exactly. They're probably a little stoic about this kind of thing.
Yeah, I used to wonder, like there was a period of the Soviet Union had, you know, all their movies, everything else they produced, you know, under a certain period of time belonged to the state. I was like, I wonder, it's a communist country, so they really, can they get upset if you use it?
Yeah, right. Well, I believe that's actually part of, isn't that the case with the BBC, because the BBC's content is paid for by the taxes that everybody owns it and can use it for anything?
I tried to look that up on the BBC. I couldn't get that exactly, but that is the case for the United States. If there's government video, like NASA video.
Yeah.
That's public domain.
I mean, it depends, because if it's NASA stuff, photos and stuff like that, you can. But remember, BBC, but a lot of that's content they license. Doesn't mean they, because they pay a license for Doctor Who, doesn't mean they
own. Got it.
They do own Doctor Who. But like, that's the thing, is that there can be a lot of, and that's one of the problems getting into, like, you know, we've talked about this. This is a topic that gets brought up, like, oh, what about government research? Government-funded research, should that all be in the public domain? And on one hand, you say, well, if we taxpayers paid for it, then yes, it should. But on the other hand, it's like, well, if it wasn't totally government paid for, you know, does that mean, you know, 30% of it, you know, and how right. does that work? And that's become, you know, that's a big issue. It's a big question. And that's one of the problems, is getting access to, you know, research and a lot of other stuff, is that you have a few companies that handle, you know, publication of science report research and all that. And you've got to pay huge fees for access to that.
Yeah. Yeah. Right on. So what about you? Got any picks?
My pick is, I mentioned before, I listened to this, and I've got a new one I'm listening to, but the last, I loved the Victorian Internet, which is all about the Telegraph. I am now working my way through, I just finished Hackers, which I really enjoyed, and now I'm listening to The Innovators by Walter Isaacson, who I was not a fan of a Steve Jobs biography, but I'm a fan of The Innovators, and it's about basically where did the computer come from, and talking about how it wasn't just one person who had a brilliant idea. It took numerous things, you know, from Babbage to Lady Lovelace to all of this, to how these things came about and how close we got, but then how far apart we were, you know, the microchip, and getting into, like, here are all the different things that came into play for the microchip to happen. But you do get some interesting occurrences where, like, the transistor was a project at, like, Bell Labs in 1939, and then World War II. You know, we talk about World War II, like, war, like, it creates innovations. Well, transistor was a hot project at Bell Labs in 1939, then World War II broke out, and it was...
All of a sudden, let's make things that blow up instead, right?
Yeah, it was a decade before the transistor got picked up again, and there's an alternate universe where that project didn't get dropped, and maybe we had the transistor in 1943, you know, or maybe not. But
yeah, I'm going to go with the controversial position that war, not great. I'm going to say, in general, we'd probably have a bigger pie if we had less of it.
It certainly does funnel a lot of money and a lot of a lot of initiative and drive towards, you know, building things, you know, making things faster and driving things. And we can, you know, it's one of these things we say, like, look at how much innovation goes back to the government. Like, wow, look at how much money they spend. You know, do we get more innovation per research dollar spent in the government than Google does? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah.
But that's kind of for sheer dollar spent. Like, you know, I'm a big fan of NASA. NASA's done some amazing things. And one of the justifications is, look at all these other things we got out of it. Like, but the question is, like, yes, but did that dollar get us more there, or did it get us more elsewhere? And
hey, random side jag. Since you're talking about government spending for advancing of sciences or whatever, there was on this week, or I think it's this week's Penn Sunday School. He brought up this. Did you hear about the gift to NASA from of two space telescopes that blew away?
Oh yeah, a couple years ago, the NSA. Yeah.
Well, he was talking like I couldn't believe how much new information I was getting when listen to him tell, because he does an entertaining job. But basically, NASA got two amazingly powerful telescopes and parts to pretty much make a third that from another governmental office, because they were obsolete. Like, what?
Yeah.
The National Reconnaissance Office, which
NRO.
This is the part I didn't know. The NRO is far and away bigger than the NSA, the CIA, or the FBI, or whatever, according by the budgets, according to...
NRO, so much of it is black budget, so we don't quite know what the funding is. We have to kind of look at the federal budget and then sort of draw circles on what we think. So it's National Reconnaissance Office. They're the ones that actually control the spy satellites. And that was, that story was, is that they went to NASA about 2 years ago, 3 years ago. They said, and actually I mentioned this in my new book, my new Jessica Blackwood book coming out, is I actually I have a side reference to that, because I have a seismologist who's dealing with a problem. He says, like, hey, when the NRO can show up and give the NASA out of nowhere, you know, because they're talking about a computational problem.
Right.
And they're like, well, is this solvable? He's like, you know, not with anything I know we have, but, you know, we just had, you know, NRO give NASA two Hubble-sized telescopes that they just secretly built. Who knows what – I mean, this is true. Like, who, we don't know – we don't know what actual – we'll hear like, oh, the Chinese set a new supercomputing record. We don't know what the actual record is because right. in the basement, the NRO, NSA, or whatever, there's somewhere there is underground several football fields of computers. And you hear about companies like D-Link, which makes a like a quantum – they make a quantum computer. They have a project. They're doing this with Google. We don't know who what their government projects are, and we don't know the state of that. And you, I bet you anything, we have government quantum computing working on all this sort of stuff, and there is multi-billion-dollar initiatives trying to do this. D-Wave, thank you. D-Link makes like modems and stuff.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
D-Wave is, you know, and they buy, and these things actually do work with certain limited tool sets. So we don't know. We don't know what's there.
Yeah. Well, and again, like to reiterate, this is a massive leap forward over the Hubble. They gave them two of them for free. And the stated reason is because, number one, they had so many others of them that these were just sitting around. Number two, also, these are the incredibly old ones that we don't yep. even need anymore and will never send to space because it's just they're garbage to us.
There used to be, it was about a 10 to 15 year lag between military technology and commercial technology. Is that, let's say you talk about an image sensor, you know, an image sensor and a camera. The military probably had ones that were 10 to 15 years ahead generations. That's shrunk considerably, but in some domains, it can still be as large.
Well, especially in I would imagine, large scale manufacturing like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, just like, even if you knew exactly, because I mean, what's a telescope but a mirror and, you know, and precision, basically. So it's like, it's not like we didn't know how to make something this powerful and strong.
Yeah, well the problem was actually, one was how do you make a mirror that precise?
Right.
That was, and then your optics on board there. So you need mirror and you need really, really good optics. So you need some sort of imaging system in there that can do that. And, you know, what's the next, you know, you can commercially, we can buy an image sensor. And you know, for it to be commercial, it means it's got to have a very low defect rate. That means that maybe 1 out of 100 don't work.
Right.
For military, you could have, you know, only 1 out of 100 actually function. And that's fine. That's an acceptable loss because you test the 100, you find the one that work, and you may have some advanced exotic process in which you make these. But because you only need to do, you know, so many, there's an interesting discussion in the Innovators about the Trident or the Minuteman missile and about how that funded transistor research, because the Minuteman was a surface-to-surface missile. This thing had to take off, had to go hit a target. So it had to have all sorts of computations there to figure out how to reach its target based on wind and all these other things. And when they started this thing, the Minuteman missile, something like a transistor was something like $500 a piece. You know, by the time they finished it, by 10 years later, you know, by the time the transistor industry got going, it was, you know, $2 a piece.
Wow. Wow.
So certainly government is being the first person to buy it. There are advantages to that. So,
yeah, that's crazy. Well, this week on political spending.
Yeah, I mean, and it's one of these things that it comes down to is like I don't think you are right. I don't think there's a yes or no answer. It sort of gets into what your preference is, you know,
I guess the most surprising part to me was that here was a branch of the government, a government office that was by far the biggest of all the reconnaissance, you know, bigger mm-hmm. than the NSA, bigger than the CIA, bigger than everything, and somehow you just never hear about them. That's fairly extraordinary.
Yeah, I mean, there was a time when nobody knew who the NSA was, you know, and that was the NSA was sort of a thing. And the NRO has worked really hard towards being very secretive about that. But,
yeah.
You know, you part of the way this works, I was with a friend driving through outside Washington, D.C. years ago. This is in the 1990s, late 90s. And he points out this office complex. This complex is like 6-story building. And he says, "See that?" I go, "Yep." He says, "That's actually like a 12-story building." I go, "What?" He goes, "Yep, there's 6 stories underground."
No way.
And it was going. He said it was going to be like CIA, but he says it was going to be an imaging facility. Was it going to be their secret imaging facility there? But then the word got out that was what it was. So then they abandoned using that building.
Wow.
It just became some other type of government building. But there was a whole level under, you know, several levels underneath where they were going to be doing all that processing, imaging, and stuff. Word got out. They said, "Nope, we got to move it somewhere else." So there is that building somewhere else. Maybe we don't know where it is.
It's crazy. It's insane.
And that's in the title, by the way, of the third Jessica Blackwood book is called Blackfall. And I get into a bit of that kind of like, how government doesn't know what government is doing, and not in some like super conspiracy thing, but just sort of these
just
little,
in a, that you have everybody doing stuff and no and you have mandates saying don't talk about what you're doing, so you're going to have giant chunks of government doing stuff that the other side doesn't know what's going on.
Yeah, and things get funded and then they get forgotten about, but they still function and they're still there. And
yeah.
So anyhow, it's been after.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.